Thank you. That's very kind of you, Mayor. In small part, some of those post-nominals relate in a small part to what we'll talk about this evening. And as we have a small group, we'll look for an opportunity to have some feedback from the audience in terms of where you want to go. It's a very broad topic. The intent is to discuss informed consent across the lifespan. So as it suggests, informed consent is the main theme. How that plays out in neonatal issues, pediatric issues, middle life, geriatric issues, quite different. In the hour or so that we have, it's not the intent to resolve detailed issues, but to give you an overview. The introduction was very generous. I maintain practice credentials in specialties that cross the lifespan. So unlike some other presenters here, I don't offer you 3 decades of experience in one field. But I do offer a perspective of delivering emergent care on a regular basis. So if you want to use your experience of the emergency department, whether that takes the form of outpost nursing in remote and isolated regions such as offshore platforms or First Nations communities in the very far north, or whether it takes the form of dramatization on television, think of the emergency department in that sense, that both pediatric, neonatal, and of course adult patients need emergent care. So there are many of us who have a sense of responsibility to being able to serve people at different developmental stages throughout their life. That's really the intent. One of the big differences between Canada and the U.S. focuses on credential and certification. So comparatively, you might say that the profession of nursing within Canada has not quite developed to the stage that it has in the States, in the sense that doctoral preparation for nurses here in Canada, less than 1% until we got past the 70s. A good 40 to 45 years ahead of us, stateside, by comparison. Until about 5 years ago, most nurses who had doctoral preparation in Canada looked at doing research and administration. They certainly weren't looking at doctoral preparation to be clinicians. What has developed in the U.S. is an understanding that that should be the norm. If we're looking at advanced practice roles, the ones that we look at typically, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, nurse midwives, nurse anesthetists, a function that doesn't even exist in Canada, but does Australia, the U.S., Hong Kong, plenty of places when we look globally. A change for us. So why give that background? This presentation will be designed to look at the issues that are relevant to us here in Canada, but give us a sense of where we might be growing to. It's certainly not the only model we look at, but it informs what we do. And largely because to this day, 40% of the nurses, not just faculty, right? Nurses in practice pursue their doctoral preparation stateside. We have very few doctoral programs in Canada that are designed to deliver practice information and practice refinement to nurses. So, by way of introduction, my profession is nursing. I've certainly taught and I continue to practice. Our focus here is to talk about bioethical issues. Let's see what happens here. So tonight's discussion, introduction of informed consent, that's fairly straightforward. So for those of us, the audience is often quite diverse. If I might ask, how many of you healthcare professionals or healthcare providers? Good. And those of you lawyers, legal professionals? There we go. So we'll try to bring everyone together. A brief discussion of the intention of bioethics. So the intent is largely to resolve complex decisions. In an hour, we're going to talk about processes that might be used, but not solve those complex questions entirely tonight. The relationship between professional ethics and bioethics. So I'm not going to make assumptions about the professions that are represented here this evening, but I may have something in common with people in the audience. We'd like to speak broadly enough that these issues will not be targeted specifically to the profession of nursing. If you look widely, you will see, however, many nurses involved in bioethics. Why? Maybe a little later. The unique perspective of the nursing profession on bioethic issues, I'm not sure what comes to your mind, but I'll raise one point now. If I was to try and contrast nursing with other practice professions, rehabilitation medicine, physio, occupation, medicine itself, doctors in simple language, those who attend with, those who stay with, those who are in the care of the patient through the night, through the day, through the 24-hour cycle, those tend to be nurses. And if we look to remote and isolated locations, to this day, the majority of those providers are nurses. There are some minor exceptions when we're looking at air medical evacuation and we're simply taking somebody out of that area. But if we're delivering services on a regular basis in those communities, whether they be offshore platforms, whether they be First Nations communities, or whether they be the population itself, the indigenous population, that care is largely delivered by nurses. Review of human developmental stages. Shouldn't be terribly long. But some of you may not have heard the word neonate before today, so we want to make sure we're all going to come along. Informed consent and relevant bioethical principles. So we'll look at terms like autonomy, non-maleficence. And for those of you where that's old hat, great. And for those of you where that might be new information, we'll give a little background, but not an awful lot. And discussion of case studies. Well, let's see. Let's see how we progress through the evening. Is anyone looking for any particular content from this evening? Be brave. It's a small group. No, nothing in particular. So if I was to ask, do you have any questions at this point? Nothing you want to speak to? Let's continue. Let's see if we can do this. So let's talk about the Canadian Catholic Bioethic Institute. That's where you are this evening. And while I'm not a representative, this came right from the website. So promote the dignity of each person, that's fairly clear. Moving down a little bit, commit to ethics, education, and healthcare and the life sciences. So they have a role, that's true. Collaborate with related organizations to provide services to the church and society based on intellectual inquiry, reasoned, rigorous reflection on moral issues that promote understanding, application of the church's teaching and the enhancement of human dignity and freedom. I'd like to engage 2 points here with respect to bioethics, because some come to the bioethics stage with an assumption around tenets and principles from religious perspectives. And it is the Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute. So let's be candid about that. Having said that, I'd like to point out that no less a figure than Margaret Somerville herself published an article in the Catholic Register in mid-October saying that when we engage these issues, and she cited 3 in particular, abortion, euthanasia, and appropriate palliative care, that her advice was that we not use religious terminology, that in fact we try to engage the argument using secular language or arguments that are reasoned. Last bit of comment, I suppose, on moral theology. No less a figure than Aquinas himself said, reason is the path to enlightenment. So I would suggest 2 applications from a bioethics perspective. We start by listening, even to those views that are not consistent with our own, and perhaps even more so. If we cannot instill a sense in the people that we're working with that they are heard, that their views are just as deserving, we will never reach that approach where we expect them to listen to us if the same courtesy is not extended. And then there's 1 step. Listen, of course. Then let's give the reflection that is asked for to perspectives that may not be our own. I'm hoping I can avoid this. To foster collaboration among interdisciplinary colleagues, bioethics and research centers, academic institutions, and healthcare professionals. in order to integrate scientific, religious, and social perspectives into bioethics. Not here to give, a dissertation on the institution, but an overview. All of this consistent with what we're looking at this evening. Elements of informed consent. So let's dive right into it. What are we talking about? What is informed consent? It's the process by which the treating healthcare provider discloses appropriate information to a competent patient. Oh my goodness, first word of challenge. So that the patient may make a voluntary choice, so it's not coerced. That's interesting. Not coerced. Anyone tell me where that line between influence becomes coercion? What do you think? You think it's difficult for a 10-year-old to make decisions without feeling the influence of the parental opinion? Just throw that out there for some thought. And of course, the challenges of surrogate decision makers, the pressures they're under. Imagine you get that call at 3 in the morning. You're first informed that your loved one is in a tragic situation, and you might have offered to be that surrogate decision maker a year or two ago. And you may not have even seen this relative for a few months, and now you're to make your way to some location that may not even be next door for you, and you've got to make decisions. Those are some challenges. What are the elements of informed consent? Well, we talk about the nature. Certainly, everyone understand what we're talking about in terms of expressing this consent. Many of us think about this in terms of a signed consent form. So we'll talk about the expression of that consent later. It doesn't always have to be signed, but that's what we tend to envision, right? That's the model, a piece of paper. Some doctor typically is going to come to us. Many of you who are receiving health care from particularly acute care nurse practitioners will be seeking the same. A written consent. Even physician assistants, and they're being utilized in emergency care in 17 institutions within this country, within this city. And when we look at ongoing care, complex acute care, well over 40 institutions within this province. So, what's the procedure? What's the information? They need to know the nature of the decision and the procedure that we're seeking consent for. Reasonable alternatives to the proposed intervention. Okay, let's just throw it out there. Has anybody here been asked to sign a consent and received information about alternatives from the person who was asking for that consent? Yeah, not a large number of us, but people are more comfortable speaking about that body of information that they can actually speak to with a degree of authority. I've had a lot of physicians say to me, I don't really want to talk to them about St. John's Wort. I don't have a clue. I don't want to talk about non-traditional, or if you prefer, non-pharmacological intervention because I'm not familiar with it. Yet processes that are structured within the regulatory bodies, the educational institutions, they require that information around alternatives be provided. There's always the null hypothesis. There's always, okay, if you don't do this, the alternative is the disease will progress. The problem will get worse. But the intent is not simply to talk about no action as the only alternative. The intent is what I'm proposing, the therapeutic intervention I am proposing, and some other. Surely there's a middle road. We're attempting to involve the patient, if you prefer, the client, for those of you who prefer still further, the consumer, the decision maker in an actual decision-making process. The relevant risks, benefits, and uncertainties related to each alternative. Has anybody seen this played out? Who typically actually gets the signature on the page? Does anyone know? Hospital environments? Is that the doctor? Do you see a lot of doctors making time to have a discussion with somebody, a lengthy 15, 20 minutes, maybe 30 alternatives? So there are time demands. There are challenges around whether it's going to happen. And whether you can actually offer relevant benefits, risks to each alternative, that's a real challenge. We can talk about generalities, but can that clinician say a 5 to 10% risk with certainty? That's a challenge. The acceptance of the intervention by the patient. So patient will probably be pejorative, but I think we'll go with that. So ethics, the rule of conduct recognized in respect to a particular class of human action or a particular group culture. In this case, we're talking about ethics that relate to health professions. And what is bioethics? Again, a simple introduction. We'll look at it a little more carefully as the night progresses. A field of study concerned with the ethics and philosophical implications of certain biological and medical procedures. Some of us take a bit of exception to that. When the public at large talks about medical, they mean it in a generic sense. Those of us within the profession sometimes use fairly precise language. So we wouldn't refer to a physician as delivering nursing services, and we wouldn't suggest for a second that a nurse delivers medical services. We're talking about medical in the broadest terms. Medical procedures, technologies, treatments. Well, here's the big ones. Organ transplants, genetic engineering, care of the terminally ill. If we look at dramatic representations, popular culture, television, or even your own personal experiences, consents get signed before surgery. Everybody knows that. But you know, there's an awful lot of procedures where we don't actually see a written consent, where the risk may even be higher than that surgery. Something to think about. Not all tonight. Take it with you. Emergencies justify a lot of things. I'm not just talking about life and death emergencies. A lot of interventions that are undertaken. Routine administration of narcotics intravenously. Routinely done. I've seen it done to family members of mine within the last day or so. Right? You go into the emergency department, you have a real problem, IV morphine. No risk whatsoever, right? Just think about it. Sometimes some of the things that we're injecting, begin to think about palliative care. Some drugs, you know, nephrotoxic, damaging your kidneys. They have adverse reactions. There's a lot of things we do. You know, we do wound closures, suturings, and bioadhesives. Simply put, glue, not uncommon. We don't get consents a lot of times for this. And when we start looking beyond the cities, you'd be amazed what doesn't actually have a written consent. Classic bioethic decisions, for those of you who aren't all that familiar. So, one heart available, who should get it? Picture says 17-year-old girl, 40-year-old school principal, 70-year-old woman, black and white, right? Dead simple. I understand what's being asked of me. I have to figure out who gets it. Well, let's change those pictures a little bit. So, Hazel gladly offered her photo for this illustration. Several years ago, I was involved in undertaking an evaluation of the emergency evacuation of the city of Mississauga, November 11th, Remembrance Day, 1979. So I was at the time working as a paramedic, and I was the first ambulance to respond to that scene and have been over the years involved in evaluations. And when presenting our findings, so those of you who have often heard we evacuated 500,000 people and no loss of life, I want you to think about what really happens when you move an intensive care unit and you shut down surgeries that are actively in process and you empty them in less than 2 hours and you do it in a land ambulance in 1979 without ventilators on board or people who know how to use them, and you move these patients 400 kilometers. I'll just let you and your mind play with that a little bit. There may not have been any official loss of life reported in the popular literature, but I want you to think about quality of care under those circumstances. Those are challenging. So no mechanical ventilators, that means people were squeezing bags. If you want to think about how long one adult human being does that effectively with the technology available in 1979 until they get to Niagara Falls, I'll just let you reflect on that. So those are the classic bioethical principles. Respect for people's rights, autonomy, dignity. Some people have grouped a lot of these together and simply said respect for people. Beneficence. Benefits must be proportionate to risk. Justice. Distribution of benefits. Look at Toronto, we can identify four academic health science centers. Simple language, four neonatal intensive care units where active education of both medical students and nursing students is underway, and faculty, clinical faculty from both professions are supervising that education. So we have access to current research. We look at that population, we can say that right now it's understood that at least a third of the population that needs services on any given day can't get the services delivered in those environments. If you want that expressed in more precise terms, we have an acuity rating system. And that system says, look, when you get to this magical number, you ought to be in one of these facilities. And fairly regularly, there isn't room to receive you in that facility. Okay? So I just want you to think about that. Even if you don't accept the generalization of a third, take 5%. Not an issue for me. Some percentage isn't receiving access to those academic health science centers. You may argue the care they're receiving in their local community is just fine, and maybe they aren't even safe to transport anyways. But the issue of justice is a real issue in terms of access to services. Non-maleficence, do no harm. Some people feel an obligation more here. I can't do everything. I can't deliver good care to everyone. But at the very least, I want to make sure I don't make their situation any worse. Common bioethics. So this next section, we can move through here fairly quickly. The intent is to give you some flavor for human developmental process. So we're going to talk about words like neonate, pediatrics, adult, and diseases that are relevant to those areas. When we talk about pregnancy, not my intent to drill down too far down here in terms of bioethical issues, but there are informed consent issues. Informed consent issues. So how many of you have heard about babies being born, whether prematurely or otherwise, with drug addiction issues? So for those of you who can't see the audience, that's most of you nodding. How many of you would be surprised to know that presently in the U.S., 42 states have laws and enforcement processes whereby they charge and take to court mothers who have exposed their unborn babies to this harm? Not that their standard or their approach is the one for the rest of the world to follow. Not that it is the only method. But it is one that is vigorously being pursued for more than 20 years now. The number of states doing this has increased and is increasing. There are 17 more states planning such laws presently. So we are taking young challenged mothers and taking them through court processes because they have exposed the children to them. Alright, so let's just say without too much detail that pregnancy is one of those developmental stages. And after 8 weeks of gestation, we're referring to the embryo as a fetus. So I don't think we have to talk an awful lot about the birth process, but there are informed consent issues, and at this point, many of you want to give some consideration to woman's body, woman's choice. How many of these decisions are only the mother's? There are countries, there are no provinces in Canada at this time, but there are two territories in Canada that require at least verbal assent from the father as well as the mother, when you're talking about interventions during labor, not during pregnancy, but during childbirth itself. So we're not going to review all of the issues, but interventions are often undertaken when there's a suggestion of fetal distress. And that's when those informed consent issues arise. As I say, two of our three territories, although none of our provinces, presently require some sort of assent, some sort of indication that the father, if present, is not opposed. Again, one of the questions you might be turning towards is how do we resolve that? It's a pressing issue. So obstetricians working in many different areas. I don't think we need to spend an awful lot of time here. Infancy, so let's talk about, you know, embryos, fetuses, infancy. Those are three stages. 4 weeks of life. Oh my goodness, a neonate for the first time. So here we have, for the first time in Ontario and Alberta, around 1985, 86, depending on which province we're talking about, we begin to see certification of nurses as neonatal nurse practitioners, and stateside about 15 years before that. Okay. So pediatricians treat children from neonatal stage through to teenage years. Neonatologists, certainly earlier than that. Sound. Childhood, oh my goodness, infancy to puberty. First year of life, toddlers, again, childhood and adolescence, 13 to 19. So before we progress, let's stop here. Let's talk about pediatrics for a second. I have some experience with neonatal pediatricians and adults, but let's talk about pediatrics in terms of informed consent. We talk about the word assent with an A rather than a common sense. We could certainly spend the entire evening and then some just contrasting the two. But the intent is that for healthcare providers to involve pediatric patients in the decisions being made. That's why I introduced at the beginning the possibility where the patient, the pediatric patient, may actually be looking for an outcome rather different than mom and dad. That's an interesting balance. So the intent of the informed consent process is to make them both aware. And assent, well, certainly they can't provide the consent. Legally, they're just not mature enough, right? Legally, you'd be looking at 18. But assent implies that we would like them to be involved in the decision-making process. And there are certainly scenarios where pediatric patients will decline and say no thank you. I have a case study, one I'll just share a little bit with you now, where a 12-year-old girl who'd been living with CF, cystic fibrosis, knew something about the trajectory of patients who have CF. She knew that very likely her quality of life would deteriorate. And she had had a very difficult time, had been in intensive care units many, many times. So we're not trying to paint a picture of how most patients with this illness, but in her unique situation, she'd had a very rough 3 or 4 years. And she knew that the next stage would involve lung transplantation. She also knew something about success rates and 5-year mortality rates. And for those of you who aren't following some of the vernacular, what we're referring to is how long this will help her and when she will get into trouble again. And she'd been mechanically ventilated in intensive care units many times and didn't want that. And so her parents' immediate response was, let's get ready for the transplant. And oddly enough, that wasn't her view. She took rather a different view altogether. And I was struck with the cogent argument that this 12-year-old little girl made after having lived through 4 years of very difficult times. Not here to present that case study, but not black and white, not as simple as, yes, well, parents know better and children will follow. Young adulthood, oh my, 20 to 40. Individuals set up their first homes, build careers, and become parents sometimes. Middle adulthood, 40 to 60. And the age that many of us are much more familiar with, older age. Well, I'm not sure I want to define that. I think those goalposts are moving, but it's certainly beyond 60. 60 till death, right? Gerontology, the medical specialty that diagnoses and treats disorders, present in old age. So I'm not here to talk about issues that relate specifically to gerontology, but to give you a bit of an introduction to issues in several developmental stages. Euthanasia is not our focus here tonight, but living wills, and appointing people as surrogate decision makers. We get these forms filled out for a reason, right? Substitute decision makers. Just a word of caution. The paper in of itself is not where you want to stop the process. You need to communicate your intentions to family members, because the healthcare professionals in that facility trying to make emergent decisions will not be guided simply by a signed piece of paper. You might like to think that paper represents your will, and the entire intent of the process is that your will would be represented when you could not represent it yourself. But if the family members present are unified and saying something different than that piece of paper does, that's a real challenge. And I wouldn't assume that the challenge would be remedied by the document. Bear in mind that in the province of Ontario, unless you have a document from the Office of the Fire Marshal, pre-hospital providers, firefighters, paramedics, even police personnel, will not respect a DNR unless it's on their unique piece of paper. Something that was published as a free document that can be downloaded from the web that all of us can use readily will not be respected. I'm not speaking out of turn or from an uninformed perspective. It is policy of this province to not ask those pre-hospital workers to make decisions unless you present it in a standard form. Therefore, pathology over the lifespan. So when we look at human development, there's congenital disorders involving fetuses. Rh incompatibility, certainly blood disorders. These are the common issues that come up. Neonates, well, born before 37 weeks gestation, often have underdevelopment of lungs and other body systems. So now we can take a look at large amounts of other issues that come up. SIDS, referring to sudden infant death syndrome and jaundice. Down syndrome. Tay-Sachs disease, sickle cell anemia, pyloric stenosis. Not here to acquaint you with all of these diseases. Point is, there are many. And this list is quite short. Right? But there are many. And so again, informed decisions need to be made. Alternatives need to be provided. And often, to substitute decision makers. Or, if a mother is present, we will certainly seek consent from the mother. But if this neonate is quite sick, how do you suppose that illness, the stress of that illness, and maybe if there was a delivery involved, mom's illness herself, you know, it might have been a traumatic situation. How are those events going to affect decision-making, the ability to be informed? Those are things to give some thought to. Infancy. Series of other issues that come up, particularly within that 1 year. Now we're talking about toddlers once again. Childhood diseases. If not vaccinated, has anybody been following the issues around vaccinations and people who are opposed to them and often for very legitimate reasons, right? They've read some article somewhere. And they're trying to represent the best interests of their own children. Anybody here been involved in that situation? Yeah. We've seen some of these standard diseases that we thought had been rather effectively contained. Some of them wiped out, literally. We've seen the emergence of polio rates rising in Ontario. We look at British Columbia and we've seen chickenpox rates in the last 6 years that we haven't seen for more than 75 years. Not here to take an argument or a stance way too detailed for tonight, but informed consent issues. Informed by who? What alternatives? Alternatives not just in approaches, but alternative delivery devices. You know, that needle isn't really the only way to deliver that vaccine. And if mom and dad are opposed to the needle, maybe there's other... We need to really look at these decisions. Diseases of puberty are the same as childhood diseases. Adolescence. There's a sense that when we look at adolescence, there's a very high willingness to engage risk. And we tend to think about traumatic injuries. But in fact, when we look at emotional health issues in adolescent populations, we see rates of service delivery that I think most of us here would call inadequate. How'd you like to wait 14 months for a referral to a psychiatrist when you're acutely just... So the social justice issue is going to surface in all of these situations. Again, who's the decision maker? And to what extent can you involve the pediatric patient, the adolescent, in assent when their judgment is impaired due to the pathology, or if you prefer, the psychopathology to begin with? The mental health illness they have is affecting their ability to actually appreciate the information you're sharing with them. Then if you force this, those are other issues. Young adult diseases. So this is screening information, but we're actually seeing higher levels of multiple sclerosis in adolescents when we look globally than we have for more than 10 years. We can talk about focuses within northern countries, but we're actually seeing a rise globally within this population, not within the disease or the burden of the disease, but within specifically this population. So that, for those of you who didn't follow that, there's a lot of decisions to be made and early on with respect to treatment options. And adult years, there we go. Heart disease, stroke, cancer, plenty of diseases of old age as well. Senile dementia and depression, what we have to look forward to. So many doctors are involved in preventative strategies. They would serve us all well. So this is a theoretical question and not all that practical. I think most of us here in our small group understand the intent, but Jane is 5 months pregnant. Which of the following terms would best describe her baby's stage of development? And we're not looking at an infant, and we're well beyond an embryo. And again, not what you came here to discuss. But again, some opportunities to apply your knowledge. In terms of healthcare providers who will be seeking those informed consents, we have had nurse practitioners in pediatrics for well over 20 years in urban centers throughout this country, and you will see more. In time within Ontario, and you'll see more by subspecialty. Physicians, that's the obvious fallback. Within 5 years, the province of Ontario is presently predicting a health human resource change so that you will see about 20% of emergent services delivered presently being delivered by physician assistants. So yet another healthcare provider looking to make these decisions. So nursing ethics, well, a code of ethics. Here there's an American model, talking about the American Nurses Association, International Council of Nurses. Obviously there's a Canadian Nursing Association, and most provinces have their own associations as well. But ethics define the practice of the professionals. Bioethics, again, interdisciplinary field. It's evolved with modern medicine. Some people would like to say that the advent of bioethics was about medicine offering cures and people living longer. You know, it's become acute because of all the benefits that healthcare has delivered. I think if you look back historically, you will see that there were biomedical, ethical issues 50 years. Maybe not as many. Maybe not as elucidated. Certainly not as illuminated. But clearly you get the point. If we went back even 400 years ago, there were issues. Who was making the decision and with what information changed dramatically. But these issues are not new to today. Dimensions for health professionals. Life and death, quality of life, right to decide, informed consent, alternative treatment issues. So several of these have already been introduced so far, and we'll take a closer look at them now. Dilemmas created by technology. Illnesses once leading to mortality are now classified as chronic illnesses. So many of us have heard about respirators, which I think is a good 30 years out of date, and you've heard me use the word ventilator at least four or five times so far this evening. How many of you have you seen people, adults in particular, on portable ventilators as a standard part of life? It's not uncommon for us to look towards a trajectory of 3 to 4 decades to say, with this mechanical device, you can live. We couldn't have said that 50 years ago. Technology wasn't. So that's an example, but take my word for it, there's plenty of issues. Cost is a consequence of prolonging life with technology. It's not the only cost. Again, limited time this evening, but I represent a profession from a nursing perspective that would argue that care, if you prefer caring, is at least as important as living longer. So the quality of life is a consideration that is at least as important as longevity. Maybe you can talk about these shifts in terms of paradigm conflicts between cure and care. Or if you wish, you can turn to our Pope and hear about a revolution of tenderness and love. What I would introduce this evening is a concern that it not just be about the number of years, that the quality of life is very much a consideration. Answering difficult questions. What does it mean to be ill or to well? Those are individual choices. People will define health and the absence of health themselves. What is the proper balance between science, technology, and the good of all humans? Where do we find balance when science allows us to experiment with the basic origins of life? Gene therapy is not where we're headed tonight, but these are issues. Nurses must examine life and its origins as well as its worth, usefulness, importance. Nurses must understand their own values. I think that's true of all of us who try to assist others with decision-making. Let's identify our own biases first. Let's keep them in check. And doing that is very difficult without self-reflection. Healthcare. Who's involved in the decision? The patient, the family, the nurse, the transdisciplinary team, all of us. Somebody's got to lead. Somebody's got to facilitate. And I'm here to argue that from a practice perspective, those of us who actually spend the time building those relationships are often in a more informed perspective than those who don't really spend much time with the patient. The value of personal belief, worth that acts as a guide to your behavior. Values clarification. Trying to sort through your own views. Are these your values? Are these the patient's values? How do we form our values? And we can offer various models for moral development. We can talk about the difference between a worldview and a value system that evolves continuously. We can even teach professionals certain theories. We can say, read this. Let it inform you. Nevertheless, there's often a long gap between our professional preparation as healthcare providers and the time at which new information comes to us in our career. We talk about continuous education. It may not be as continuous as we'd like to think. They need to examine their own values and they need to commit to a virtuous value system. You need to have a worldview. You need to know what your own worldview is before you can guide others. Encourage responsibility for living life. Prepare one for making ethical decisions. learning right and wrong. Well, how do the patients get there? That's an interesting perspective. So infants, no concept of right or wrong. That's fairly clear. We begin to see some development here under school-aged children. Good behavior is rewarded, bad behavior is punished. And beginning to make choices based on understanding of good and bad. Adolescents, my goodness, they're questioning moral values and relevance to society, becoming aware of contraindications and contradictions in adult value systems. Don't do what I say, do what I do. Cognitive dissonance. Johnny believes all men who hit their wives are bad. Johnny also believes my dad is good. Johnny just sees his dad hit his mother. One of these conflicts has to be resolved. Cognitive dissonance. One of these values is now in question. We don't always, as adults, whether we be parents or otherwise, give consistent messages to adolescents. Theories of moral development not going to help us a lot, except to know that they're there for those healthcare professionals trying to pursue them. If we were to list values, or if you prefer, bioethical perspectives, these are the main ones that we're going to deal with. Altruism, the intent of doing good, equality, aesthetics, oh my goodness, the love of things, beautiful. Freedom, human dignity, justice, and truth. Truth telling, how important, veracity, how important to inform decision making. If you're not given truthful information, you can't make that informed consent. So, two different models we're presenting here this evening. One, utilitarianism. How do I accomplish the most good? And two, deontology. A view about duty and obligations. Many of you would look towards Kantian deontology, for example. We're not arguing that healthcare professionals need to pursue one particular approach, but they ought to select one that they are familiar with and allow to guide and inform. There are many people who really think that what we ought to be doing is the greatest good, but that's sometimes conflicted with our duties. Purpose of ethical principles: to establish common ground between nurse, patient, family, and other healthcare professionals, society, to discuss ethical questions and make ethical decisions. Permit people to take a consistent position on specific or related issues, and provide an analytical framework by which moral problems can be evaluated. Well, that sounds so simple. Autonomy. Well, there we go. Respect for the person. So, my body, I decide. It's all about rights. Unconditional, intrinsic value for all. People are free to form judgments and actions as long as they do not infringe on others. So those are the classic bioethical questions, right? When is the embryo a person? When is the fetus a person? Are there two bodies? Is there just one? Concepts of freedom and informed consent are grounded in this principle. So you're going to run up against autonomy on a regular basis, respecting the individual's right to decide issues that affect them personally. Beneficence, oh my goodness, we're here to promote goodness, kindness, charity, abstain from injuring others. Common bioethical conflict results from an imbalance between demands of beneficence and those of the healthcare system. So we can't always do the good we'd like to. But what happens today on arguments of prejudicial care? Patients admitted to hospital. Patient has had a long-standing bias based on skin color. If you prefer, ethnic origin. patient has for the last 20 years refused to purchase the services from anyone with a skin color not the same as hers. She finds herself in hospital and says, I don't want care delivered by anyone of this color or this ethnic origin. What happens? What do we do? Is that request honored? That's my question to you. No, it's illegal. We don't honor it. Okay, now let's flip that on its head. What if that prejudice is based on gender? Do we honor it then? Do we say to the man who is a nurse, you deliver care to everyone? Or do we say, imagine a 12-year-old boy who has been identified as having a sexually transmitted disease, and his family physician says, you need to see a specialist, and she's in the next room. And the 12-year-old boy says, no girl is going to examine me. Well, that takes on a new complexity. Now we're talking about a pediatric patient. Oh, wow. These are issues I encourage you to think about. Are we consistent? We are not. Do we say, well, yes, that person is saying, I won't accept care delivered by this person from this ethnic origin, but that's a senior and she has dementia and, you know, sounds simple. You know, not so simple. We want to resolve that in a way that is beneficent. We want to deliver good care. But our concern isn't just about the patient, is it? We're concerned about the people who work in those institutions. We're concerned about family members. Not so black and white. Non-maleficent. Well, we certainly don't want to do any harm. We certainly don't want to force care on Mrs. Brown, who has said, I don't want care. And she, remember now, she didn't say, I want the highest quality available. Her concern was not about the competency of the person delivering the care. It was about the origin. We don't want to do any harm. We want to abstain from injuring others, and we want to help others further their own well-being by removing harm. Veracity. Outside of healthcare, everybody's honest every day, right? And lying is intentional deceit, never happens. Very, very common. Very, very common. Principle of truth-telling. Consumers expect accurate and precise information. I don't think anybody has any problem with that statement. For trust to develop between providers and patients, there must be truthful communication. Okay, so yesterday you were fine, today you're in hospital. Let's use that analogy. You didn't build a relationship. You saw this provider for the first time 5 minutes ago. You're building that relationship on certain assumptions. And one of them is the assumption of truth-telling. Without veracity and without truth-telling, our relationships begin to deteriorate in a fairly significant way fairly quickly. Any doubt? Turn to those situations where you've learned you've been deceived. I think that will be instructive. The challenge is to mesh the need for truthful communication with the need to protect. We certainly don't want to overwhelm people with more information than they can process. This is one of the traditional challenges around informed consent. Ethical decision-making model. Oh my goodness, we do these four things, it'll be simple, it'll be resolved. Identify the ethical issue and the problems. Identify and analyze available alternatives. Select one alternative and justify the selection. So that's simple. Just do a little research and the informed consent will happen immediately. It's not a problem. You are going to need to be prepared. You are going to need to do a little preparation before you try to facilitate the resolution of this bioethical issue. What's the issue? What are the hidden issues? What are the hidden issues? What are the complexities of the situation and is anything being overlooked? So here, cues, right? We begin to understand that it's not black and white, that there are other issues going on as well. Imagine you're in an intensive care unit with a much older gentleman, someone in his early 80s, has had a bad fall a few hours ago, massive head injury. His children appear in the intensive care unit. His spouse is there. His son has been appointed as a surrogate decision maker. I wonder how quickly the surgeon's going to turn to the son and not to the spouse. then it gets a little more complex. Different family members want different outcomes. Some of them are saying, yes, I believe in science. I believe in prayer, too. And I'd like at least 24 hours to do a little bit of that. Thank you very much. Why are we having a discussion about turning off a ventilator when night hasn't yet passed? It's a bit premature for me. Is there a scarcity of resources? Are we so short of beds you can't give me a second day? Lots of hues. What are the reasonable possibilities for action? So yes, we can look at complexities and then let's get practical. Some things are just not realistic. This person who's been told that his 85-year-old father has had massive damage, and both a neurosurgical resident has told him this and an intensivist has come along 6 or 7 hours later and confirmed it and said, your father has no hope. There's just absolutely no way he's going to live, and even if he could, you wouldn't want what's left. He's trying to grapple with, I believe in miracles. Not so easy. How do different parties want to resolve the problem? Very difficult for healthcare providers to work when they're not receiving one message, but multiple messages. The family is not one person, but could be many. What ethical principles are required for each alternative? What assumptions are required and what are their implications? Okay. So we're not all going to become bioethicists here tonight. I think we've established that. But as people who are interested in bioethics, knowing how clinicians work through these issues may be of some interest to you. And we encourage them to try and justify the selection internally before they present it to the patient and family or the group that they're supporting. Clearly present ethical basis for these reasons. Understand the shortcomings of the justification and anticipate objections before you present them. So there are issues around life, reproduction, death, injustice. We can go on. They're replete. So we have a lot of different terms now, right? Bioethicists, clinical ethicists, clinical bioethicists. My goodness, on and on. We need people prepared to assist us with those decisions. Veracity, paternalism, autonomy, and accountability. So by paternalism, we know better. We will decide for you. Sort of the polar opposite of autonomy. Veracity, is that a new word? Iatrogenesis. How about nosocomial infections? Hospital-acquired infections? Are we getting there? Iatrogenesis, fancy word. You got something, you received harm, and you ought not to have. Iatrogenesis may be defined as any adverse condition in a patient resulting from the application of a treatment by a physician, healthcare professional, or member of the writ large medical team. These events contribute significantly to patient morbidity and mortality, illness, and death. What's the extent of this? It's a nice statement. What sort of percentages are we talking about? So we have a population of around 35 million. And if we look at days in hospital and the number of people get treated, we can tell you that of those who receive care in an acute care environment of one day or more, that's not admissions, that's frequently treatment in a short-term assessment unit, that between 20 and 25% of those patients receive that effect. That might be as simple as getting phlebitis or inflammation in your vein when somebody took a blood sample, or an actual infection when they started intravenous therapy. Or it might be so bad that you were involved in a research project and you were signed on to this research project because, my goodness, you had cancer. And you might be in real trouble and you really might need this. And because of a labeling error, instead of getting the meds you were supposed to get, the medications you were supposed to get, you got triple the dosage. And now you're actually quite sick and we have to remove you from this research project. And it was, in fact, your last hope. very, very serious issue. If we look at the states, we can tell you that in 2012, 650,000 people actually sued for iatrogenic effect. Huge numbers. So they involve longer stays in hospital, a lot more money to care for people and to correct the problem. And if it's the one government, the one province, the one country that's funding that care, the effects are pretty dramatic. A substantial percentage of iatrogenic events are preventable. Iatrogenic events may not be the result of medical errors. So what's this got to do with informed consent? So you were harmed by a mistake someone in that healthcare system made. What happens to truth-telling and veracity? Should there be a clear statement of fault and an apology? What do you think? Did we do something wrong? Let's think about human relationships for a minute. Someone let you down. They disappointed you. And they did something professionally they ought not to have. And while we might not be able to say with certainty what person made this mistake at midnight, we certainly know it was an error of the healthcare system. So we found that apologies and straightforward communication not only work towards the resolution of the bioethical issue, but they have value to the people involved in those relationships. Harm may come to patients due to known complications of treatment, such as chemotherapy. We knew from the outset that harm was going to come to you, as well as failure of a patient to get appropriate care, unnecessary care, poor or impaired medical judgment, from a physician failing to put the good of the patient ahead of his or her own. But rare, right? Never happens. Very rare. So we work together, health professionals, and when one of us is having a difficult day or a weak moment, we expect the other to step in as a patient advocate. And if you are hearing for the first time that drug addiction and making decisions when you're exhausted and being on call and coming in and having colleagues discover that there's alcohol in your breath and you're agitated and your decision-making is novel and new and hasn't yet happened, then check those assumptions. These are regular occurrences. So we all have regulatory bodies, and many of the people in this room are either regulated or have participated in the regulation of others. It's a regular occurrence. Iatrogenic events may be minor or life-threatening. Institutional or system failures, such as insufficient enforcement of standards for hand-washing, oh, it's simple out, right? Writ large, everybody's involved, and I didn't wash my hands well enough, and we spread germs around, and people got diseases. Resulting in inappropriately high rates of healthcare-associated infections, and they may also result in iatrogenic events that harm patients. I lifted somebody when I shouldn't have, and they slipped, and they hit their head on the ground, and they actually didn't survive the head injury. Here's one case study I'd like to share with you. A 7-year-old boy with a relapse of acute myeloid leukemia, if you don't understand the terms, you will get the picture, not essential, did not respond to any of his cancer treatments, including a bone marrow transplant. Sort of running out of luck. He was hospitalized to implement a research protocol with a new investigational drug for that cancer. A thorough process of informed consent and assent involving the 7-year-old boy. It's easy at 12, 14, 16. Now we're talking about a 7-year-old boy. It's involved, consent and assent, and was followed and signed by the child and the parents. So presently, I sit on a committee in 3 different hospitals, acute care environments here in Toronto, where we evaluate consent processes. If we're talking about pediatrics, one of them is obviously sick children. We don't actually document, I'm not trying to reveal trade secrets here, but the extent to which we document the assent of pediatric patients is not uniform throughout the province. So there are institutions that are leaders and try to set examples, but the documentation is not quite as strong as we'd like it to be. During the first 3 days of chemotherapy treatment, the child had significant side effects, including high fever, neuropsychiatric symptoms. Very simple. Mother became very alarmed that something was wrong. This is often the suggestion. If ever a parent says to you, "This is something's wrong," we listen very carefully. These are the people who spend most time with these children. The history's there. Subsequent investigation revealed the pharmacy. Oh, terrible story. Let's see what I can do there. Let's just make sure we follow this. On the fourth day, the principal investigator, that's of the study, principal investigator, was informed the entire study drug supply had been given, contrary to the protocol instructions. So rare, never happens. In Toronto, in acute care environments involving pediatric patients, right now there are more than 300 and less than 400 trials right now. How many of those scenarios will result in this one? I'd like to tell you that there are checks and balances and that it is uncommon, and as you, long as you don't ask me to define uncommon, I can say that quite comfortably. But to suggest to you that we would use a case study that's not relevant to this province and not relevant to this city, that's not what's happened here. This is a case study that came, is relevant to this province and this city, and was not taken from a vague country, far off, distant location. It's a real scenario. Subsequent investigation revealed the pharmacy had received a new batch of the drug with the same appearance but a different concentration. This is a lucky hospital. This hospital has a separate pharmacy just for research. A labeling error then led to administration of an excessive and nephrotoxic, damaging the kidneys, dose of the drug. The end result was cessation of any further experimental therapy. So let's remember the situation that this 7-year-old was in that caused the situation in others. The child lost his last chance treatment. He died a few weeks later in another hospital, community hospital, from where the family originated. Review of this event identified an error caused in part by insufficient staffing of the research pharmacy. For those of you who are looking for real specifics, that's not really a separate pharmacy, but a portion of the pharmacy assigned to research. Insufficient staffing of the research pharmacy and failure to recheck medications prepared there. Oh my goodness. His young child and his distraught parents had negotiated their way through the vicissitudes of daunting cancer treatments, including bone marrow transplant, only to see their hopes for recovery dashed by this iatrogenic event. So, again, if this is news that we make mistakes, please don't let it be news. What are the moral and legal implications of this event? These are some questions, not ones to which we're going to provide answers, but this is the bioethical decision-making process. Let's identify the issues. Was this iatrogenic event the responsibility of an individual or the result of failure of systems within the hospitals? That's why we gave the discussion about the pharmacy and the providers. What is the role of an apology and repair in the setting? Iatrogenic. So that's an example that we've all read a case study on. But these events happen in small ways every day. A medication error, I slipped when I was trying to lift somebody. Lots of examples every day. And so what I would suggest is that if you are coming at this discussion this evening because you are a healthcare provider, that you might want to examine the role of truth telling around this issue and begin to engage some questioning and some examination around those procedures where you seek informed consent. You have the capacity to initiate change yourself. We have standard forms. We know what those are. Surgery, yes, absolutely. Anesthesia, yep, they get a consent form. But I would suggest to you that there is care delivered by a good number of us as healthcare providers and received by many of the people in the audience and their family members, where a consent form may not actually be used, but the threat level is actually quite high. And a lot of these times we say to the person, this is what I'm about to do, how do you feel about that? Informal consent. There are many of us who would argue that if it was worth engaging in that activity, it was certainly worth documenting that activity so that everybody's clear about it. Because there are certainly events that pose risks to us as patients, as consumers, where informed consent is not sought. Well, here's a really interesting one. A 3-week-old recovering from pneumonia is about to undergo surgery for a tumor that is partially obstructing the left main bronchus, one of our big breathing tumors. Not the biggest, but one of two big ones. The anesthesiologist reads the chart, examines the child, then he shakes his head and sighs. Frightened teenage mother observes his unspoken actions in petrified silence. So the harm that is done is often not restricted to actual harmful care. 4 years ago, I was involved in a research project that examined questions that we ask on admission. And we looked at people presenting with mental health issues. And we looked at those admission questions, both in specialty hospitals and in community hospitals dealing with people who had mental health issues. We discovered that simply asking somebody who is experiencing a mental health crisis sufficient to bring them to an acute care facility, have you ever suffered sexual abuse, is a question that asking that patient to ponder can in fact worsen their state considerably. And that if we didn't have therapeutic value, if it wasn't actually necessary to pose that question ought to be dropped from those admission forms and processes because it in fact had destabilized a number of acutely ill patients in which there was documentation to support this. So for years, many hospitals were asking these questions because enlightened, intelligent, well-educated people put them in the forms and then other people administered the forms. Not always the best thing to do. Sometimes we need to tailor processes to people. And if we think that posing certain questions might be very harmful, then we might want to reevaluate whether in fact it's the way to proceed. What's this got to do with informed consent? It was actually given as an information sheet that nurses were to read when admitting someone and then to seek the patient's consent around the admission. So what we actually observe can be harmful as well. I don't want to walk you through these events, but I think we'll stop there. Do you have any questions of me? Before I put you to sleep, let's summarize a few themes, see if we can wrap a couple up. Informed consent is necessary for a lot of the therapeutic interventions delivered by healthcare professionals. We're clear on that. And we know that it needs to be a voluntary decision, and that it needs to be an informed decision, and that it shouldn't be coerced. And we know that with pediatric patients, we should try to involve them through assent. We know that with neonatal patients, often it's a substitute decision maker who's making a decision around consent, but that this mother may be focused on challenges relating to her own health, to the stress of having a sick, premature infant, and that there are social justice issues around the delivery of services. We know that truth-telling is intrinsic to that relationship, and that the person who is making the decision relies on us to share accurate information, and that honesty be involved in the seeking of that consent and in sharing any information that might threaten that relationship. Last comment, thank you so much for making me realize this evening. I do hope there's been some value. So we'll leave it there. No other questions. Please.
I haven't heard of physician assistants.
Sorry, one more time?
I haven't heard the term physician assistants.
perform the role. No, let me, sorry, better for me to clarify before answering. Thank you, Ben. Yeah, it's a role. It's a healthcare provider. We call them physician assistants. So, plural, TS, assistants. And they are often prepared now, some prepared now in an undergraduate degree, but there are still some academic institutions at the undergrad level preparing them with a two-year diploma. I think within two academic years, the standard in Ontario will be an undergraduate degree. The standard preparation stateside is master's preparation. And their intent is advanced practice. So much like a nurse practitioner, they will be doing a lot of things that you would typically expect a physician to be doing. In the literature, we would call them physician extenders. They are taking the histories. They are undertaking the exams. And they are often fairly independent. The primary difference, if we contrast them with nurses, who all have a baccalaureate preparation before they look at an advanced practice role, is that by statute they do not have independence. They are working under the supervision of the physician, whereas nurses are educated and prepared for independent practice and autonomous practice, so they don't have that degree of independence. But if we judge them in terms of the nature of the interventions that they deliver and the kind of care that they provide, one might not see a big difference in the actual end of delivery. Big difference in terms of preparation. So if you looked at the emergency departments of Sick Children's, Mount Sinai, the University Hospital Network, St. Michael's, you would see physician assistants working in all of those emergency departments. Does that help?
It does.
So that doctor, if that 10 minutes is related to an informed consent, that doctor is highly invested in getting that signature. And one of the most effective ways to stop the process is to demonstrate unequivocally that your questions haven't yet been answered, and that you need more information, and that you're reluctant to sign at this point until some more information. We use three different standards. Eh? We talk about a standard of reasonableness, a physician-judged level of reasonableness, and a patient-centered level of reasonableness. How do we decide how much information to give? Am I overburdening them? I mean, different people have different capacities to receive information. Their illness might alter their experience. It may just be their educational level. Maybe they don't really want the equivalent of a literature search represented in a 10-minute speech. These are the questions that clinicians would throw back to me. They'd say, well, how do I judge? Where's the magic tool? What makes it abundantly clear what I have to tell them and what I don't have to tell them? When I tell them too much, maybe I'm going to frighten them unnecessarily. What I would suggest, is that we ought not to be making those decisions based on what the reasonable physician thinks that he ought to deliver by way of information. I'm aware of four meta-analyses, big, large research projects, that took a look at this question from many perspectives. Four done over a period of 22 years. Large meta-analyses. And every time we ask the question, do doctors tell them enough when they're making informed consent decisions, the answer consistently, without exception, came back, no. So there are varying levels as to how much more I should give, but nobody's saying we're giving enough. And what we're saying is the standard used ought not to be what the reasonable approach from the physician's perspective. What about the reasonable approach of what a patient ought to need? If we look at many of the states, they have enacted laws that say we don't even want the reasonable patient standard. We want a third standard, and that is actual need of patient. Don't make what a reasonable patient ought to know the standard. Don't make what a reasonable physician ought to deliver in his mind. Because we already know physicians underrate this. We've understood this from research.
what many of the states are saying, assess that individual patient. Find out what that individual patient needs to know for them to make a decision and meet that need. And that's legislative. We're not talking about a suggestion, right? And that's come from substantial research that says different people have different needs, and if we want that to be a truly engaged and informed consent, you're going to have to make those assessments individually. The challenge of doing that involves time and resources. We haven't even talked about assessing comprehension. We haven't even begun to say, all right, so you gave them lots of information. Were you able to determine whether they understood you or not? And certainly you have to assess comprehension before you can ask them to sign a document. Language problems, comprehension problems. What about dementia that comes and goes? What about overwhelming pain that interferes with my ability to make that decision? But in 2 hours, I might be lucid. What about I'm lucid today, but I wasn't lucid yesterday when the doctor saw me? What about the social worker saw me a week later and thought I was just lucid, just fine? This is replete with challenges. Replete with challenges. But everything that we have attempted to question about the informed consent process tells us emphatically that the best results in every outcome measurable are achieved when it is an informed consent. We accept in law, we accept in moral practice, we accept in ethics, we accept in bioethics, and we accept in human decency, human relationships, that it is necessary to be an informed consent. But we're not terribly good at it. When we examine it on an institutional basis, whether you're looking at IRBs or otherwise, when we examine it as individual professions, when we examine the issue as clinicians, we find that this is one of the areas that we tend to tack on at the last minute. Pre-op meds given, patient ready, all the procedures ready, ORs here, check this, check that. When we look stateside, for those who've done published research in this area, we've set up checklists for consents. Was this done? Was this done? Was this done? We consistently find ourselves at the 11th hour not even completing the checklist. Because our focus is the intervention. Let's deliver this service. But we have a long way to go in informed consent. If I take any more of your time, I really will be stretching to interview. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, David. It's actually what you've really done, I think, is highlight